Does it get you in the zone?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Hello and welcome to That's What She Said, the fortnightly intersectional feminist podcast bringing you current news and a badass woman from history. With me, Hannah Thacker.
And me, Nina Rattridge.
Hey.
Hi, Hannah.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm really grinning for some reason. I don't know why. I think I'm ready to be back on the mic.
This is where you're meant to be. Yeah. Like being on the stage. Yeah. No one can see you.
This is my happy place. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm good.
Good.
Nothing to report.
That is always a good thing.
Well, I started in my new job.
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good discount, that kind of thing. And have you done anything fun?
Well, I went to Girl Gang Manchester pub quiz.
Oh, I forgot.
Which is great, and lots of feminist-themed questions.
Oh, I was so gutted to miss that.
Such as, there was like snippets from autobiographies, like audiobook autobiographies.
Oh, right.
So reading them out, and you had to, say whose autobiography it was. And it was a lot easier, because I'm so glad it was like them speaking and not some random person like Stephen Fry reading out Charlotte Crosby's. Might have been a bit confusing.
He does read everything.
Stacey Dealey's was on there straight away. I was like, I've got this in the bag. And I joined a team with one of the organisers of Girl Gang Manchester, so okay, I felt like the pressure was on to be like very knowledgeable.
The most feministist.
Yes, exactly. And I definitely wasn't. I definitely put down some wrong answers, but yeah. I was there, and that's the main thing.
I went to a different pub quiz that night, actually.
Yeah.
And one of the questions was something about a country singer with big boobs, but not worded like that. It wasn't as bad as it sounds.
Uh-huh.
But I spent so long trying to remember Dolly Parton's name
when
I'd already written the name Dolly Parton, and then I spent the rest of the night going, no, it's not her, it's the one that they're on about in Dumplin', the one that sings, oh, I can't even remember, what did she sing? And then I finally was like 9 to 5 and they were like, yeah, Dolly Parton.
Like, oh, it shit. Happens. Your brain just goes to a place and you can't get it back.
I'm not good at quizzes.
I'm pretty good. I have the confidence of someone who is good. I'm not always like,
I used to be that person, but then many, many weeks of doing pub quizzes in Durham just completely knocked me down.
Oh, no.
I was like, I know nothing. I can't even feign confidence anymore because they actually question it.
Yeah.
And someone does know the right answer.
There is always someone.
Yeah.
Someone. The other thing that I have done in the past fortnight was go to a people's vote rally in Manchester.
Oh, of course you did. You've been doing so much better than me.
Well, do you know, I think we might have said this even on the podcast, that one of our things for the new year was to go to more protests.
Mm.
It wasn't quite a protest. It was a small rally
of
Labour Party members, of which I am not very much. I'm a floaty person.
Same.
But it was very... I went because I don't actually know that much about the people's vote.
No,
I do tend to avoid Brexit news.
I think we all do now.
It gets on my nerves. Mm. However, I was invited by the team behind a blog called Not My Breakfast, which is all about trying to make sense of Brexit.
Oh,
and
that sounds like something I need to partake in.
Yes, get on there, because they just make complete sense of it all for you.
Okay.
And also remind you that it is actually really important to take notice, because it's going to affect your future. And that is terrifying.
It's really stupid, because I studied a lot about how... and I've written a lot about how it's important to engage in politics even when it feels like feels pointless.
Mm.
But with Brexit, I've fully resigned to the fact I can do nothing, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I think they're showing one way that you can do something, you know, the people's vote. So for anyone that doesn't know, the people's vote is a call for another referendum to decide what is the outcome of Brexit with a... no exit option on the ballot paper.
Yeah.
Some people have suggested we should have a no deal option on the ballot paper. That is truly horrifying that
would
be
anyone... Why would anyone ever want that to be... Don't put that as an option.
Some people do that for... people do that for a laugh. And then...
That's so stupid.
When they're living on rations,
yeah,
they won't be laughing.
Eek. I was in Leeds, and I was around the place where someone's put all the billboards up of politicians' tweets pre-Brexit.
Hmm.
You know, like all the hypocritical things.
Yes, I have seen these.
Yeah, I saw one or two of them in the flesh.
In the flesh.
Yeah, in the paper.
I have seen there's a anti-Brexit van going around with tweets, like foreboding tweets, like Nissan won't pull out, and one from Farage saying, I never promised it would be perfect.
Yeah.
What the hell? Skin crawling.
So we all need to get on that blog and learn and re-engage.
Yes, and that's good. Give us a flavour of what the blog's all about and what the people behind it are all about. The founder of the blog, Julian McLaughlin, gave an awesome speech at the rally.
Yeah.
Especially focusing on why it's imperative for young people to be engaged in politics. And a week later, I met up with her again to record her speech and just ask her about the People's Rally. And I'm going to play it for you now. So, Julia, we met at the People's Vote Rally in Manchester. Can you tell people about the People's Vote and your particular involvement with that?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting because I've come quite late to the People's Vote, to be honest. You know, people have been campaigning for this for months and months and months and even years. For me, it was kind of like after the 2016 referendum, I was really disappointed, but I did think the referendum had been won democratically and legitimately. And I thought, you know, the government would be able to negotiate some sort of deal that obviously wouldn't be as good as EU membership, but it would be all right. And then over summer, you know, these things started coming out about Leave EU overspending. Obviously, we found out that a lot of claims made by leavers were lies, like the £350 million for the NHS.
A number plucked out of the air.
Yeah, a number plucked out of the air. And then, I mean, what really frightened me was more and more kind of experts coming out and saying these are the impacts that Brexit will have. And then more recently, kind of this shift towards maybe a no-deal Brexit, which, you know, I thought would be an absolute catastrophe, and many people think would be an absolute catastrophe. And I'm quite scared of lots of jobs being lost, of the economy taking a massive hit. And I don't think that's something that Britain can survive easily. I mean, we saw after the financial crash in 2008 how hard many people were hit. Years and years of austerity that made people's lives more difficult. And I think that Brexit will have this impact on people as well, especially a no-deal Brexit. So it's kind of all these worries building up, worries about a no-deal Brexit, but also this feeling that actually the vote wasn't won democratically, that people had been lied to, that there was illegal activity on the Leave side, that really galvanized me and really made me think, actually, we need to stand up and say something. Something's going really wrong here. And that's kind of what led me to campaigning for a People's Vote.
Yeah, so you feel very much like the original Brexit referendum, it was an unfair vote for an unfair future, and now we should be allowed to have a second say because we are have more knowledge now, and we see the very scary reality that we're faced with. So for people who aren't aware, what is the People's Vote?
Yeah, so the People's Vote is basically the idea that people deserve a final say on the Brexit deal that has been negotiated by Theresa May. It's not, you know, lots of people see different options that there could be a no-deal Brexit on the ballot paper. I find that a bit scary.
Yeah, a little bit.
To be honest, but I think that the ideal thing would be Parliament is deadlocked, can't decide on Theresa May's deal, but also can't really decide on any other way forward. And in a situation like that, I think it should go back to the people, because actually what they voted for in 2016 was a very abstract idea. It just said leave or remain. Nobody knew what it would mean to leave. A lot of promises were made that aren't being kept now or can't be kept. It's becoming very obvious. I suppose no one had really thought about the whole problem in Ireland, the problem of a hard border in Ireland if there's a hard Brexit. This is something I'm very concerned about, and I think many other people are very concerned about as well. So the basic idea of the People's Vote is that democracy didn't stop in 2016. Actually, people should have the right to vote on what Brexit will look like now that we actually know what's possible.
Absolutely. And part of your involvement, I suppose, in the people's vote and making awareness is especially for young people. And this led you to create your blog.
It's called Not My Brexit. Sorry, Not My Breakfast, which was a bit of a joke because, you know, Theresa May kept saying Brexit means Brexit. And then we'd go for breakfast and say breakfast means breakfast. But this isn't our breakfast. So it's called Not My Breakfast. And our subtitle is sort of Dispatches from Brexit Britain. And yeah, so the idea behind the blog was that I started talking to lots of my friends who are, you know, super smart, really interested, but even they felt like they couldn't understand what was happening in the process at, you know, that point in time. And I think to an extent, that is what our government wants. I think this conversation has become so, so complicated that unless you have masses of time to dedicate to this, it's actually quite hard to work out where you stand and where the issues are. And I saw the blog as a way to, well, kind of share with my friends what is going on at the moment. So it was meant to be, you know, quite a practical place where young people could get information on Brexit that is relevant to them. Also, if people decided that they did support a people's vote, I would have resources there that would link them to other pages, that would tell them kind of how they could get active, which groups to join, etc. But yeah, I think young people need to be more involved in this because the great tragedy, obviously, is that 70% of young people voted to remain in the EU, whereas roughly 70% of old people voted to leave the EU. And I feel like in this whole discussion, nobody's thinking about young people. Like that's never seems to be on the agenda. You know, all these problems surrounding the backstop, it's all about leaving at any cost. And I personally think the cost is now just getting too high, especially for young people. And, you know, we've already heard of so many companies who've stopped investment or are leaving the UK. Nissan basically yesterday said they won't be producing their new series of car here, even though they were going to. And they said Brexit was one reason. And, you know, that's jobs for young people. Yeah. That's our futures. The idea behind the blog really is to get young people to stand up and just say this isn't okay. A lot of people are, you know, on the edge about whether they support a people's vote. I think that's totally okay. It's not the most straightforward choice necessarily because it will be difficult to organise another referendum, but I really see it as the only way forward to stop what would be a catastrophe for young people's futures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think what I've seen is the rhetoric has changed recently for the older generation worrying about the future of their children and grandchildren. So I suppose blogs like yours, it's not just for young people and the issues that concern them, it's also for the older generations and to see, you know, what their descendants are going to be dealing with.
Absolutely. And I think that's something, you know, when they talk about bridging these divides, I think the old-young divide is quite a serious one at the moment. And I think for older people to kind of read the worries that young people have, that certainly would help with compassion towards why younger people want to stay in the EU, because I think older people who, you know, maybe they've have a house paid off, they've established themselves in a career, you know, all these very serious worries about the economy around Brexit, they don't affect them as much as young people.
Completely.
And to actually, you know, hear from your niece or granddaughter or, you know, daughter or son that, you know, they're really, really worried and they see that jobs in their industries are being moved overseas, like that can really change things, I believe.
So obviously people should go and check out your blog, which is, again, That's Not My Breakfast.
Yeah.
Do you have social medias?
We do. We have a Twitter. It's called @Brexit_dispatch. We're currently working on an Instagram. We're all very busy, so haven't managed that yet. But maybe by the time the podcast goes out, we can like link it in the show notes.
People are going to have to go to a good old fashioned website.
Yeah. You might have to go. Yeah. This is funny because like I'm probably the least media savvy person on this planet, but I've like started this blog and I've tried to start a Twitter, and you know, I've got more Twitter followers now on my blog than I've ever had on my personal Twitter. So it's, you know, small gains.
Absolutely. And the reason that I asked you obviously to come talk is because I heard your wonderful and very engaging and empowering speech at the People's Vote Rally. And I'm hoping that you'll read it out for the listeners.
I can read it out. Yes. Would you like me to go now? It's going to be hard to muster quite the same energy.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of energy, wasn't there, built up from the day. Well, what was the, we had some brilliant posters we made earlier.
Oh, yes. We had Farage not, no, sorry, wrong way round.
Fromage.
Fromage, not Farage. Not the other way round. We had pulling out doesn't stop people from coming.
That was highly popular.
That was really popular. That got a lot of photos taken. Just trying to think what else we had. Oh, we had a bad idea is a bad idea forever. I mean, mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. it was actually really fun. It was nice. You know, a nice thing to do on a Saturday when the world seems quite scary at the moment. It was mm-hmm. nice to, you know, be in a group of young people who do really care and who do want to make a difference and who are not going to take this just lying down.
Absolutely not.
All right. So I shall read my speech.
Go ahead.
This month, together with a group of friends from Manchester, we started a blog that documents young people's voices on Brexit, and many feel like we aren't being listened to, that our concerns don't matter, as the government is trying to push through Brexit at any cost. Young people's voices are not being heard. Our voices were not heard when 70% of young people voted to remain in the EU. Our voices were not heard when many of those whose futures were being decided couldn't vote because they were told they were too young. And our voices aren't being heard now as politicians prioritise the survival of their parties while Brexit is plunging our country into crisis. We are sick and tired of being lied to, of being appeased and told Brexit will be smooth and orderly when it is anything but. Our government has no idea how to proceed, Parliament is deadlocked and a no-deal Brexit is looming. This has to go back to the people. We need a final say. We're sick and tired of being branded Ramonas, of being told to shut our mouths and pipe down because we had a referendum in 2016. Things are going really wrong right now, and I believe we have to stand up and say something. We will no longer stay quiet because these are our futures and we have something to say. We're afraid of violence returning to Ireland. We're afraid that social inequality will rise even further as goods and services are going to become more expensive. We're afraid of what a shortage of EU doctors and nurses will do to our NHS. And we're afraid of jobs being lost as more and more companies have stopped investing in Britain and are moving their operations elsewhere. This is not Project Fear. P&O announced they're going to register their fleet of ferries under the Cypriot flag. Sony is moving its European headquarters from London to Amsterdam. Airbus has called this government's approach to Brexit a disgrace and warned that it could pull out of the UK. I applaud the Tory business minister Richard Harrington for calling out this government on its scam of pretend trade agreements and for standing up to Theresa May to say that a no-deal Brexit would be a disaster. How dare they lie to us and claim young people's future prospects won't be devastated by Brexit, whether that's Theresa May's bad deal or no deal at all. Young people, and those already left behind, are going to be the most affected by Brexit. And let's face it, we're already screwed. Many of us have come out of university with huge debts, we're less likely than our parents' generation to ever own a house, and now politicians are gambling our futures away to deliver a Brexit that looks nothing like what people were promised in 2016. So why are we going through with a Brexit that will make most people in Britain worse off? So we can claim we took back control? Empty slogans don't pay our rent. Empty slogans don't address the staffing crisis facing our NHS, or homelessness, or poverty. And empty slogans don't guarantee a good future for young people. Young people in Britain have to stand up. It's time to say that we oppose a Brexit that will make us poorer and will threaten the stability of this country and the Good Friday Agreement. We need to mobilise. We need to make our voices heard. We need a people's vote. If you believe that young people in Britain deserve better, it's time to stand up and be counted.
Yes.
Yeah, there
so
we go.
So good. So good.
Thank you.
Yeah, everyone, you know, obviously, that has rung out true to you. Do check out the blog, follow them on Twitter, and thank you so much for reading
that. Thank you.
Out.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
You're welcome. Like you heard on there, they have socials, so go follow them. They're on Instagram and Twitter, I believe.
We'll link it up anyway from our end.
Yeah, we'll include all those links. All right, so do you have some current news for me?
I do indeed. Continuing our world, I don't know why we always seem to be like, we're travelling the world with news. It's like, no, that's the point. We just don't just...
We're too poor to get on a plane.
I go on the search engines for the news. But yeah, I'm going to take you to Uganda. Okay, so in Uganda, so the tourism minister, Godfrey Kiwanda, has suggested showcasing curvy women as a way of attracting more tourism and more visitors.
Okay.
Pretty twatty move. This is only a little, it's not a long story, but it was just remarkably stupid. And I thought I'd shine a light on it because this guy's a politician. And why a politician still is fucking stupid. So, he was at the launch of a plus-size beauty pageant, Miss Curvy Uganda, in the capital of Uganda, Kampala, and he sort of described his plan, if you might call it that, for using such curvy women as a way to attract tourists.
Right.
You're looking confused.
I am confused because I don't really understand what is happening.
No.
But okay.
Yeah, it's pretty much just as it sounds. So he was on stage at the event and just during to the contestants on stage with him, he said that full-figured women were, and I quote, the story to sell to visitors. So, I know, I don't really, it's just baffling.
Just, okay, sure.
Naturally, there's been a lot of backlash to his interesting comments. People have called them dehumanising and degrading, and a petition has been launched to get the plan and the pageant itself scrapped.
So what? So he's having a pageant of curvy women.
I don't think the pageant was him.
Okay.
But
there is a pageant of curvy
There is
women.
A pageant, and he wants to use women like that as a marketing tool, I guess, essentially.
Right.
And sort of in the vein of, this is the kind of women we have in Uganda. Come and take a look, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. I can't claim to understand the mind
of
this man.
This isn't a new advertising tool.
No, but I think the many issues, but I think it was the brazenness of, it's kind of normally an advertising tool that is a little bit like sex sells, it's a bit unspoken, but not, this was very much like, look, curvy women, I'm going to use them to get people here.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Why?
Not cool.
No.
No, I've been tackled.
Oh. All right, Dad. So, speaking at the launch of the pageant on Tuesday, the minister said it would be an exceptional event that will see young ladies showcase their beautiful curves. We have naturally endowed nice-looking women who are amazing to look at. Yeah, you said that. Amazing. Oh, okay. Right. We have naturally endowed nice-looking women who are amazing to look at. The Ugandan news site Daily Monitor has quoted him as saying, why don't we use these people as a strategy to promote our tourism industry? A strategy.
Just the whole language.
Yeah, it's disgusting, isn't
it? Like, use and these people. Mm. And like, I think you said before, like, the story to sell.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh.
Like, no, it's not a story to sell. It's like these women's lives and existence. And you can't just pick them up and use them as a marketing tool. So, unsurprisingly, there was swift backlash to the proposal online, like I said before. Mr. Kiwanda was accused of talking about women as though they were zoo animals, with one woman even questioning whether they would, and I quote, be put in a cage for tourists to see. There's been a change.org petition launched, by Primrose Murungi, a campaigner from Uganda, and she wrote that she feels personally attacked by the idea and called for Mr. Kawanda to issue an apology to the public, of which there has not been yet. She said, "This is degrading of women. They are objectifying us and reducing women to nothing." Yeah, like I said, the Ministry of Tourism has yet to publicly comment on the criticism. So there are some publicity photos from the event, which I thought were pretty interesting, because I'm assuming that these were after he'd said what he'd said on stage. And it's the Ministry of Tourism, Godfrey Kawanda, stood in the middle with five of the contestants around him, and they're holding a sign that says, "Launch of Miss Curvy Uganda. I will be there." But the looks on all the women's faces are so done with this shit. Like, I hope that's what's happening, because that's what their faces look like. Like, he's smiling and looking really pleased with himself. And they're all so,
have you, like, got a picture?
Yeah. I'm going to put it on the socials, but
absolutely none of them look remotely impressed or even present. They're just like, let's just get through this.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's that.
Wow.
Ugandan tourism minister, one to watch for being a twat.
Yep.
He's quite young as well, which surprised me. It kind of disappointed me a bit. Like, he doesn't look more than 50, 45.
Stupidity has no age.
No, I know, but you kind of just think, oh, I thought we were getting better, younger politicians in now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole big world. A whole world out there of misogynists.
I know.
So,
doesn't have age limits, but it'd be nice if it was just going to grow out.
Yeah, I'm glad there's backlash to it. Yeah. And women are being outspoken, and there is campaigns set up to go against that.
Yeah, it's that kind of like little comment that would be quite easy to, obviously it's not a little comment, but I feel like it would be quite easy to just be a bit like, oh, this is gross, but it's just the way the world is. But we don't do that.
Yeah.
You call it out when it happens, and that's what they did and are doing. So good job, Primrose Murungi and the other campaigners against this.
Yes, indeed. So, speaking of a campaign of a different sort,
okay, a theme I see.
It's an advertising campaign, but
okay,
much more positive.
Oh, good.
Have you seen Sainsbury's All Boobs Welcome campaign?
No.
So,
oh my god, I'm so excited! A supermarket. We've not talked about one yet.
We actually haven't. So, most of my info comes from The Drum, an article by Rebecca Stewart. The All Boobs Welcome campaign was created by an advertising company called Porters, which is part of Two, which is Sainsbury's clothing line.
Oh, as in Two, like two, as in not two.
T-U.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. It's part of a wider BU initiative.
BU?
Yeah, which is a bit cringe, but All boobs welcome, I enjoy.
Oh, BU as in be yourself, not the letters BU. I was like, why is that cringe, Hannah? You can't write off two letters of the alphabet. That's cringy.
Don't like those two letters.
Oh, BU, right. Make me cringe.
Oh my god. Anyway.
Don't know what that was.
So the campaign centres around a video which has been shot by women, of women, wearing their underwear and describing their boobs.
Ooh.
They use words such as knockers.
Yep.
Fried eggs.
Yep.
Crumb catchers.
Okay.
And saggy and baggy.
Have you heard Tic Tacs before?
No.
I went to a Zumba class with my mum once and she told us to shake our Tic Tacs, the woman. And I just looked at my mum like, oh my god, I want to leave.
All of these just made me quite queasy. Mm. And interestingly, they're not positive.
No.
And the campaign actually is in, I suppose, response to findings that 71% of women feel lingerie ads are engineered to appeal to men.
Oh god, yeah.
Very true.
You fucking kidding me?
Yeah. And I was, surprised it was only 71%. And then only 56% of women said they would describe their own breasts in a positive way.
Okay.
So speaking about the campaign, creative director of Portas, Zara Ineson, said, "The sad fact is, advertising is way out of touch with what women want when it comes to bras. It was time to get real, so we flipped it. Together with Two, we created a campaign that celebrates normal boobs, no matter what shape or size they come, the ones which life has gifted us.
Interesting use of the word normal.
Yeah, it is hyphenated.
Yeah.
I don't know whether she hyphenated it.
I've just done a seminar on the normal, and
okay.
Basically it's just fascinating because the normal is like a much smaller category than all the many abnormals mm-hmm. put together.
Yeah, I think when she probably means normal in the opposite sense of that. Yeah. Normal as in the boobs everyone has.
Yeah.
And then the whole, like, normal just loses its exactly. meaning at that point.
Normal means nothing. Yeah. Spoiler.
Something that all the women involved in the campaign have taken part in is writing love letters to their boobs.
Aww.
And they're going to be sharing that on social media along with self-portraits of their boobs.
Okay.
Which is cool.
They should draw them with their boobs.
What do you mean?
Self-portrait of their boobs by their boobs. Like, dip your boobs in paint.
That is great.
I might try that.
Yeah.
I've been watching too much Grace and Frankie. That is a very Frankie move. You know what I'm going to ask you? Are you finished?
Yeah, I'm done.
You know what I'm going to ask you? How do you describe your boobs?
I've never
thought about it.
No. Never thought about it. Like, I just don't even care.
Weighty.
Oh my god. You just totally just had a crazy ex-girlfriend flashback.
Heavy boobs. I got them heavy boobs, that one.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I can't relate.
Oh, I couldn't relate to that much either. That was a different league to me.
She does have them heavy boobs.
She does. Mm-hmm. That song's amazing, but I was cringing the whole video because she's really like whapping them about and it looks so painful.
Yeah, there's a lot of boob choreography.
Oh, it looks so painful. Cringing.
But yeah, I have no word to describe my boobs.
Think of something. Homework. Something positive.
Oh, okay. Something positive.
Yeah. We're joining the Sainsbury's campaign, Hannah. Come on.
But why do you have to name our boobs?
Not name them.
We don't name anything else about our body.
No, but just describe them in a positive way. Tell them they're good.
I feel very average.
Oh, no, that's not the point. You just can't read an article about boob positivity.
Yeah, but I don't feel like negatively about them. No. I just feel like they're all right. I don't know what they're there for. They're just there.
I think we do know what they're there for. We're just not serving that purpose yet.
Well, for some people, that's what they're there for. For others, they are just there.
Okay. Interesting. I'm going to think about my boobs now a little bit.
Okay.
That's my homework anyway. You don't have to do anything.
Maybe I'll do a pitch.
I like the way that's you're like half-assing it. Like, I just wanted you to describe and you're like, no, okay, I'll do the boot picture.
I'm more of a visual artist.
Yeah. Write a song about them, please. I've got a story that amused me slightly.
Okay.
Not because it's funny, just because it's kind of like a ha-ha thing.
Like a, what's he called from The Simpsons?
Nelson.
Nelson.
Yeah.
Ha-ha.
Kind of. Like a baby Nelson, not a full Nelson. Ooh! What's a full Nelson?
It's a wrestling move.
Is it?
Yeah.
I just went, oh, I've heard of that. Okay, right, okay.
Oh, I made a sports joke.
Never done that before. Okay, so this is from Pink News, which is one of my favourite news sources. I've realised as well that I know we don't have very strict rules with what we include content-wise in the current news, but it's kind of supposed to be geared towards women's issues slightly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I kind of have noticed that I tend to take that a bit loosely and I just like to talk about gay shit quite a lot.
Well, we are intersectional feminists, so that includes a lot of things.
Yeah. So anyway, I've got another gay story.
Okay, hit me with it.
So, a recent survey focusing on school performance of children in the Netherlands, has indicated that kids raised by same-sex couples achieve better test results than those raised by your heteronormy couples.
Oh my god.
I know. This is kind of just weirdly exciting to me and I don't know why.
Yeah, it's cool.
So economics researchers at the Belgian university KU Leuven compared the academic achievements of 1,200 kids raised by same-sex couples, and more than 1 million children raised by opposite-sex couples. I like that they're called opposite-sex couples. It sounds funny. Who were born between 1995 and 2005. The study analysed the results of a standardised test children in the Netherlands take at the end of primary education, usually around the age of 12. For around 18% of participants, researchers also collected information on their diploma results at the end of secondary education. And the researchers wrote in the paper, Our findings indicate that children particularly benefit from same-sex couples compared to opposite-sex couples if the couple is cohabiting rather than married. Interesting.
Hold up. Say that again.
So
same-sex couples who are cohabiting rather than married.
No, opposite-sex couples who are cohabiting rather than married. Compared to same-sex couples.
So are they telling us that marriage is not only the death of your relationship, but also of your child's education?
No, the other way around.
Oh.
Wait. Yeah, the other way around.
Okay.
So I guess they would be saying that marriage does better for the test results.
Okay, I suppose that more stable home environment and all that jazz.
Okay. They also found the same results for secondary education. The results suggesting that children from same-sex couples are 6.7% more likely to graduate than children from opposite-sex couples.
Mm.
How bonkers is that?
Wow. That is great because it proves everything that
I know, that's what
say.
I mean, yeah. I think that's why it was
proves...
Is wrong. Disproves.
Yes. Yeah, there we go.
I knew what you... Yeah. Now, that's why I think it was a Nelson moment for me, because I was just like, yeah, all your fucking fears aren't true, are they? I love it.
I think there's something to be said for the difference in data pools. So you've got 1,200 kids from same-sex couple families and 1 million from opposite-sex couple families.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're not going to find as many children from same-sex couples.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's going to have to be an ongoing study to find, like, you know, more children coming to the world from same-sex families.
They kind of highlight this, that also in 2013, though, it was like the results were the opposite way around. So yeah, they are continually researching this, and something must have shifted in the past 6 years? Is that the right number? Yeah, maybe.
I think one thing that's always going to stop a kid enjoying school is being bullied. And if they're being bullied because they've got two dads or two mums.
But 6 years down the line, that happens less.
There's a lot less.
Interesting. There's so many different things you can take into account with it. They have to consider the socioeconomic conditions of all the couples involved as well. And the researchers believe that the socioeconomic conditions of the same-sex households the children grow up in may be a factor in their academic performance. So they say, our results mostly support the selection approach, stating that given the time-consuming and costly procedures for same-sex couples to obtain children, same-sex parents typically have a high socioeconomic status, resulting in higher parental investment, they state in the paper. Yeah, that I think I was kind of going to bring that up anyway. Like, yeah, if you've gone to that much effort to get a child, it's gonna be something you invest more time in, potentially, than if your child was an accident, maybe.
Fair enough. Not for everyone.
No, no.
But I think it's definitely a good point about, you know, if you have to have other means that aren't straightforwardly natural, then, and it's going to cost more money.
Yeah.
You know, kids from more well-off families are going to do better at school. Yeah. That is just a fact. Sad fact, but true.
Yeah.
But this, it's interesting, like, how that difference of having same-sex parents means, you know, you're more likely to come from a well-off family or, you know, have a better education.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you seen Sex Education on Netflix?
I have.
Have you seen all of it?
Yes.
Have you seen, what's the name of the swimmer guy, Jackson, is it?
I'm going to go with yes.
Yeah, I think it is. Because he's got two mums, hasn't he? And that was, to me, a very, like, relatable portrayal of, not relatable, but, like, I've seen that portrayal before of same-sex parents.
Yeah.
Being very, like, involved in their children's life because they really want them to do well. And obviously all parents do. I don't know, this is kind of a ramble, but just in it's a different type of parenting, I suppose. And
what I liked about that, though, was the difference in the parents, because typically when I've seen that portrayed in film and TV, the same-sex parents are really, like, lovey-dovey, like, oh, we're so nice because we're same-sex.
Yeah.
Like, and then, like, opposite-sex parents can be, like, all kinds.
Mm.
Whereas his parents, like, one of them was a lot kinder and one of them was a lot more strict.
Yeah.
So I think it showed probably a more realistic version.
I'm fascinated by it now, you know. I want to watch everything that has, like, the same-sex family dynamic portrayed in it.
Yeah.
And look at how...
That'd be a pretty cool study.
I want to do... Oh, dissertation.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Have you just got your dissertation?
I think I just got my dissertation.
Yeah!
Something about that, anyway.
No, that'd be so good. Like, people would actually use that.
Yeah.
Not just a dissertation that no one ever looks at.
Oh, my God. My undergrad.
Most of them.
Shit, son. Remind me to write that down.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is why we need a person.
I know. I've been thinking that recently. I need someone that's going to, like, make notes of when we say funny things and stuff.
And we have brilliant ideas.
Yeah.
Which is all the time.
I know.
And they just go to waste because there's no one there to write them down.
It's not like we're recording or anything, so we can't listen back ourselves and find out.
Who has time for that when we're constantly thinking of new ideas?
That's all they do. All day.
Oh, dear me.
So just final note on that. They take into account what we talked about and the they did the maths, did a sum, whatever, and took out the socioeconomic status to see if there was still a relationship between the parents being same sex and the test results, and it showed that there still was a slight but smaller skew towards the same sex parents.
Cool.
Which is interesting.
Good to know.
Also a note that they weren't able to include children raised by single LGBTQ plus parents or bisexual and transgender couples.
Okay.
So I think that would need a bigger pool to study.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah.
So as you've been back on your fave pink news, I have been back on my fave bust.com.
Yay!
So this is an article by Francesca Volpe looking at the 4% challenge.
I'm intrigued.
Have you heard?
No, but I like percentages.
Cool. I know, I love percentages. Who doesn't? Something tangible. So, at a recent panel at the Sundance Festival, which focused on narrowing the gender gap in Hollywood, actress Tessa Thompson gave a speech announcing that she will join the 4% Challenge, which is a campaign from Time's Up and the Inclusion Initiative, which encourages filmmakers to commit to working with female directors, especially women of colour, within the next 18 months.
Okay.
So according to the study conducted by the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, from 2007 to 2018, only 4% of 1,200 top grossing films were directed by women.
Mm-hmm.
Which is teeny tiny.
That is a little bit small, isn't
it? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so this pledge has been put out by Time's Up and Inclusion Initiative, and lots of filmmakers and directors and actors and actresses and studios have been sort of pledging to the campaign.
Okay.
You can find the current list on Time's Up website, which includes notable names such as Reese Witherspoon, obviously. Her own production company pretty much makes only female-led films, and she's amazing.
Yeah, I think I've listened to a podcast with her once, and I was like, I didn't know you were cool. It must have been Curious. It'll have been a Jonathan Van Ness.
When I was 10, I used to watch Legally Blonde on repeat.
I've never seen it.
Okay, this is what we are doing. Yeah. Oh my God.
Let's wrap the podcast. I've seen bits of it. I've never seen it.
It's so good. Mm. Okay, right, we're doing that. Other names on the list, Natalie Portman, Jane Fleming, J.J. Abrams, Eva Longoria, Brie Larson, and major production studios such as Paramount, Universal, and Warner.
Okay.
As well as many other names.
Yeah.
I don't know them all because I'm not very pop culture switched on.
Okay.
But, yeah.
I'm going to look at that list because I probably know loads of them. Probably. And I'll feel,
Oh, God. No, so much more than me.
Oh, only about stupid things, Hannah.
Yeah, that's the 4% challenge.
That's cool. I hadn't heard of that under that name. I think I knew it was kind of a movement that was happening, but I didn't know it had a name. So, kind of a a heavier one.
Okay.
And just a heads up, I'm going to be talking about abortion for the next 5 minutes, probably, for anyone listening who needs to know about that. Okay. So, this is from the US website Feministing, and it's an article by Senti Sojwal. So, last month, January, marked the 46th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision that affirmed the constitutional right to safe legal abortion in the US. Almost 50 years later, despite near constant attacks on abortion access and a largely anti-reproductive health Supreme Court of the US and White House, Americans still overwhelmingly support the decision of an individual's right to make their own choices about their reproductive futures. So an organization called Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health just released the final results of the Turnaway study that explored the effects of abortion access on an individual's existing and future children in the US. Earlier findings from the first research project of its kind included that those who are denied access to abortion are more likely to be below the poverty line years later, have more difficulty escaping domestic violence, and that the vast majority of those who received abortions felt it was the right decision. Significantly, the recent study results showed that the economic and developmental well-being of already existing children is negatively impacted when individuals are denied abortion care, and that children born later to those who are able to access abortion experience more economic security and better maternal bonding than children who were born because the parent was denied a wanted abortion. In the US, more than half of those seeking abortion are already parents. And according to Diane Green Foster, the lead researcher of the Turnaway study, there are three sets of children whose lives may be affected by whether or not an individual has access to abortion. The types of children whose lives may be affected by whether or not an individual has access to abortion are the children someone already has when seeking an abortion, the child born from an unplanned pregnancy, and the children born from pregnancy after an abortion. It's a bit dense, but it's quite interesting, the results of this. So the study finds that children born of those denied an abortion had greater odds of living in poverty compared to children of those who received a wanted abortion. So Foster, who was one of the lead researchers on the study, notes that the Turnaway study represents an important shift in perspective away from framing abortion solely as an issue of women's rights versus fetus rights, which is why I found this so interesting, because I'd never seen a take on it that actually takes into account other children in the families of people who have an abortion.
Right.
And obviously the fact that many women have abortions when they're younger and then go on to have a child when they feel ready, and that means that they're much better equipped to look after that child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a take on it I've never seen before. So she goes on to say that given that abortion has been legal for 46 years, and actually quite common before that anyway, many of us are alive today because our mothers were able to avoid carrying a prior unwanted pregnancy to term. Abortion ends the possibility of one life just as it enables women to take care of the children they already have and make possible a desired baby later. When individuals have control over when they have children, they are better parents to those children. Both existing and future children are more likely to have the resources and stability they need to thrive, to live healthily, happily and successfully with parents who are financially and emotionally ready to child rear. When we deny people abortion care, we do a disservice to children present and future, and this is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I say, I've never seen a take on it like that before, which takes into account, yeah, other children and families, and just puts a new angle on the debate that shouldn't be a debate.
No, there should not be a debate at all. This actually brings me to a piece of news I didn't think I was going to talk about on the podcast, but I did research, which is the fact that it is still illegal to have an abortion in Northern Ireland. And it's been processed recently with, you know, placards saying that we will not be left behind, because obviously there was the Fifth Amendment in Ireland just last year? Was it the end of last year? And that came into action in the new year, which has made abortion legal in Ireland now. And it was a truly shocking read. The official statistics in Northern Ireland is that they have 12 abortions a year.
Okay.
But those are for the, like, the most life-endangering, the most, like, particular cases that they allow. But in actuality, there have been 900 abortions in that time.
Yeah.
But these are women who are, you know, having to fly to England, having to buy drugs offline. There are people going into prison for taking these drugs offline or buying them for other people. You know, even if you were raped or if you were, if you're under 16 and you get pregnant, you still are often denied an abortion in Northern Ireland. So I think the fight goes on, definitely, and just because one place, you know, right next door to them has it, doesn't mean that the problem's solved.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. I was actually, again, listening to an episode of Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness, and he talked to Jodie Pico, the author, who does quite a lot of, like, really in-depth on-the-ground research. And she spent some time at an abortion clinic, and one of the things that stuck with me was that she was talking about how often the people the women protesting outside to try and stop people to go in and have an abortion would come in one day for their abortion and then be back protesting again the next day. And it's just crazy that if you've got that right, you'd be protesting people for using it. I don't know. It's just a crazy minefield of...
It is. It is. There is no easy way to move on from this topic.
You can try.
I can try. So I'm going to stick around in the US, as you were.
May as well. Flight's a dear.
To talk about the State of the Union.
Okay.
Which is a big old piece of news.
Yep.
So I looked around at a few different articles. You will find something about the State of the Union pretty much anywhere. Obviously, the Independent got my back.
Bloody love it.
I do. They've got brilliant writers. What can I say? This is by Serena Bergman. So the State of the Union this year also marked 100 years since the 19th Amendment of the Constitution, which gave the women in America the right to vote.
Okay.
Very exciting. So in solidarity, many of the women at the State of the Union wore suffragette white.
I didn't know suffragette white was a thing. What's
I think
suffragette
in America.
White?
It's suffragette white in America.
Okay, that's weird. Cool.
I know. Whereas obviously over here it's green, purple and white.
I truly don't know.
They're the suffragette colours in the UK.
Okay, I'm a bad feminist. I didn't know there were suffragette colours.
I've read in some places that it was democratic women, or women of the Women's Working Union. But anyway, a bunch of very badass women wore white to the State of Union in show of solidarity.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about some of these women. Florida Representative Lois Frankel, chair of the House Democratic Women's Working Group, tweeted, "Wearing suffragette white is a respectful message of solidarity with women across the country and a declaration that we will not go back on our hard-earned right." Another woman worth mentioning is Representative Ilhan Omar, one of the first two Muslim women to be elected to Congress in the last year's midterms. She wore a blue headscarf and red sleeves with her white suit referencing the American flag. So Omar, alongside fellow Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley, also wore a pin featuring Jacqueline Carl, the 7-year-old Guatemalan girl who died in US Border Patrol custody in December. Tlaib tweeted, "We are bringing Jacqueline Carl into the room with us during the hashtag SOTU, so State of the Union." They said 12,800 children are in detention camps via federally contracted sites. Now they said it was more than 15,000.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Other women wore eerie yes buttons on their lapels to acknowledge the Equal Rights Amendment, which makes women equal to men under the Constitution. It was passed in 1972, has never been made law, and still needs to be ratified in 38 states.
What?
Yeah, that's the majority of America.
Yeah.
Refuses to recognise that men and women are equal.
Okay.
Mm.
That's good.
Super.
So reassuring.
I found it quite interesting. So much focus was put on what women wore. It happened in 2017 in the first State of the Union where women wore white, including Melania Trump.
Yeah.
Interesting. And maybe a former version of myself would have been like, it doesn't matter what they wear. Like, why are they commenting on the colours of their headscarves or like anything? But when it's used like this.
Yeah, no, this is.
It's a political statement.
Like, this is the nature of the State of the Union. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's very much. It's not a discussion, is it? It's him. No. It's a speech that he gives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not for them to. They're not allowed to comment on it at the time, but they can dress however they want.
Absolutely. So it's like a non-verbal protest almost.
Yeah.
Like their message is being put out there because there is so much media attention put on it. And it does really remind me of our discussion of Feminists Don't Wear Pink.
Yeah.
Which if you haven't checked out our first episode of That's What She Read yet.
I know, that's exciting.
Absolutely do. Where I read out an extract from Emmetal Mahmood's Sharia State of Mind on how a choice of her wearing a skirt or trousers wasn't just about practicality or style or comfort. It was a political statement.
Absolutely.
So yeah, clothes can be a very powerful thing indeed. Yeah.
They're so passive and yet can do a lot. So I'm big on it as a statement. I think it's good.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It was very cool. Yeah. There are so many great pictures from
I think I've seen some pictures. Yeah.
I think it's like Lois Frankel, she's doing like a pointed hand clap.
Oh my god, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's so good at Donald Trump, like, yes,
oh, you
fucking
need to see
got
that.
Got you. And then I think it was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just like in the most amazing power suit, strutting past all these like really young interns. And so many memes, like when someone doesn't care who your daddy is.
Oh my god, I just did such an ugly laugh at that because that's so good. Did you see the ones, because she was wearing an Apple Watch in one of the pictures, like visibly.
Okay.
And it was on Twitter, like her watch was showing a tweet, but you can't see what it is, so everyone's just zoomed in on it and then put what tweet they want it to be. And it's
so
funny. Rob Delaney did one and it really made me laugh. I love him.
Oh, I'm gonna have much fun looking at these. Anyway, that's all my news.
Yeah, I think we're ready for
Baddest Woman from History.
Ball for her.
No.
Oh god. Okay, I'm gonna read you the first line of one of the articles about her before I say her name.
Ooh, suspense.
I don't know why I'm gonna do that because you won't know her name anyway, but this is just a great opening line. With her passion for wine, swords, and bomb-making, Xu Jin was unlike most women born in late 19th century China.
Me and her have so much in common.
Oh my god, same. It's actually just what I put on my Tinder bio this morning. So, I'm going to tell you the story of Xu Jin, who was a feminist poet, a revolutionary, and a martyr, known as China's Joan of Arc.
Oh.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of her at all.
Me neither.
Just to say.
And also it really kind of annoys me when we have to do the thing of, they're this country's version of this person that you've already heard of, so now you can understand the story. Like, no, she's just Xu Jin doing her thing.
Cool.
Okay. Xu Jin was born on November 8th in 1875. Her family was part of China's large class of civil servants, with a great-grandfather who had been a magistrate and a father who held a minor bureaucratic post that forced the family to move several times in the 1880s and 90s. Zhu's mother was a particularly well-educated woman for 19th century China and ensured that her first-born daughter would follow a similar path. With access to private teachers and a range of reading materials, both of classical Chinese sources as well as works in translation that were filtering into Asia, Zhu seems to have been especially moved by accounts of the French Revolution an important text that came out of Europe's Age of Enlightenment. She was a bright and charismatic child and was doted upon by family members, including an influential grandfather. In her teenage years, her parents acceded to her wish. Is that right? Acceded?
I don't know.
In her teenage years.
Acceded.
It's acceded. I think acceded. It is a word, but I don't know it, so I'm going to change it.
That's a nice new word.
So in her teenage years.
Sorry.
Oh my gosh, the same words. In her teenage years, her parents gave in to her wish to begin training in a traditional Chinese martial art of sword fighting, which was unusual for a woman of her time and class. She may have had her feet bound at a young age, a practice which deformed the feet, making them small with artificially raised arches and inhibited walking. But we're not sure whether or not she did have this.
Okay.
Though it is a theme in some of her poems, which is interesting. She always loved to write, and in this period of her life, she wrote many joyful poems on subjects ranging from flowers and the four seasons to visiting historical places and domestic activities. She also wrote about female heroes and warriors from Chinese history, including the Mulan.
Oh.
Mm. She wrote about them in inspiring poems about their strength, courage, and beauty. One of her poems begins, "Don't tell me women are not the stuff of heroes." Her poetry reflected her self-confidence and desire to become an excellent female writer as valued by traditional Chinese culture. Xi's birth city was Xiamen, a major coastal city in Fujian province that in the mid-1870s was known as Amoy. I just gave myself a sentence with three place names. I hate myself, clearly.
You made that tough, but you did well.
Thank you. We don't know I did, but... the family later moved back to their home of Shaoxing, another coastal city located south of Shanghai across Hangzhou Bay. Xiamen and Shanghai were among the five treaty ports overseen by a British colonial administration after having been taken by force in earlier decades. Valuable natural resources including tin, copper and other precious metals, plus spices and lucrative poppy crops that made opium. A drug. It specifies that it's a drug, which is good to know.
Yeah.
A drug with high global demand in the late 19th century, were taken freely out of China by the British East India Company and other legitimate entities granted access to Qing Dynasty lands in a series of humiliating treaty concessions.
That sounded very historical.
It was a big old sentence, yep. But it was some context. I liked a bit of context.
I enjoyed it.
Interesting
context.
Interesting.
Interesting.
It's interesting history. Oh dear. Okay. British, French, American, Dutch, and other merchant nations operated with impunity in China during these years. They had the right to station warships and use military force to secure their economic interests, along with the freedom to govern themselves in foreign colony enclaves such as Hong Kong. Millions of Chinese, descendants of one of the world's most advanced ancient civilizations, lived in poverty, and there were periodic famines. Even nominally middle-class families, like the Xi's, suffered hardships and became increasingly politicized due to the Qing dynasty's inability to curtail foreign domination, especially after the brutal suppression of the Boxer Rebellion in 1901. When Xiao Jin was 19, in May 1896, she obeyed her father and married the son of a wealthy merchant, Wang Tingjun, against her wishes. A son was born to the couple in 1897, followed by a daughter 4 years later, but Zhu was unhappy with the restrictions of marriage and motherhood. She came to loathe her husband, who spent ruinous amounts at gambling dens and brothels.
Sounds like a right
tit. Stellar guy. That's funny enough, that's how she does know. A right tit. The poet strikes again. Mm-hmm. So she actually wrote of him, "That person's behaviour is worse than an animal's. He treats me as less than nothing. And when I think of him, my hair bristles with anger. It's absolutely unbearable."
Oof.
I think it's kind of crazy that she was writing this quite publicly. Not publicly, but I don't know how we know that. How did the word get out of that? This is her writing. Like, she wrote this somewhere and now we know about it.
Well.
And it's not her diary because that's buried with her. That's a spoiler.
That is a big old spoiler.
What, that she's dead?
Yeah. You're telling me this now.
Okay.
How am I supposed to be invested in her...
Was from the 19th century.
Okay, so yeah, I should
The chances were pretty high that she's dead, but I'll let you off. Thanks. So, the bad man, the bad husband. So, because of him...
Bad man.
No.
Sorry. Keep derailing your story.
It's okay. I'm fine. I'm fine. Her previous self-confidence was shaken, and her dreams of becoming a recognised poet were abandoned. Her poetry from this period of her life was full of self-doubt and loneliness.
Mm.
I tried to find a lot of her poetry, and there's not an awful lot, but what there is remaining is pretty cool. Those translations. Anyway, during this period, Zhu also began writing poetry about current events and the fate of China. After hearing of events such as the Boxer Rebellion and occupation of Beijing. By the way, I know I've mentioned the Boxer Rebellion a few times.
Yeah.
I did research it.
Yeah.
It's just your standard history story of rebellion. I can't remember.
And why Boxer?
I don't know. I think I did. I looked it up and decided it wasn't worth including.
Cool.
And I'm sorry if that's offensive, but it was taking me way too far from the main...
You know, people can Google.
Yeah.
You've got the ability.
Yeah.
Whoever's listening out
there. I know
there.
I did a whole section on tin and copper and that, but I decided that the Boxer Rebellion wasn't worth including.
We'll keep repeating.
Yeah. I think this is the last time I include it, so you can let me off. After hearing of events such as the Boxer Rebellion and occupation of Beijing, she used her poetry with literary allusion to heroines of the past to express her concern about the fate of China and Chinese women in particular. Zhu longed to serve her country but realised that wasn't possible as long as she was trapped in a conventional married life. Her marriage was an important catalyst in her development as a feminist and revolutionary. Nothing like a bit of darkness to bring out your light.
Whoa.
That was me. I didn't
write. Nina just said that while looking into my eyes and not blinking.
I must be feeling poetic today. In 1903, Zhu Jin moved with her husband to Beijing, where he had purchased an official post, as you do.
Mm.
In Beijing, Zhu started reading feminist writings, became interested in women's education, and started to meet like-minded women. The women were aware of emerging educational opportunities in Japan, a smaller nation, but one of equal power and influence in Asia. Previous Japanese rulers had more successfully resisted European encroachment, and in the late 19th century, Japan underwent a significant overhaul of its political, social, and economic traditions. By 1900, Japan had schools and training colleges open to women that were attracting Chinese immigrant women too. So, can you guess what she did next? She moved to Canada, you're right.
Oh, you didn't let me guess.
What were you going to guess?
Don't know yet.
You're going to try and think of something funny.
I was.
I'm sorry, there's a timer on humour.
Oh, fuck.
Most of my bad jokes happen because I can't wait to think of a good one. I have to just get something out. Okay. Zhu Jin finally left her husband in the summer of 1904, pursuing her interest in Japan and leaving to study there. She left her children in the care of her mother-in-law, with whom she had a, inverted commas, cordial relationship. Zhu's widowed mother also supported the move, which Zhu financed by selling some of her jewellery after Wang, her husband, refused to part with any of the dowry funds she had brought to their marital union.
Again, such a tip.
He's a good guy, isn't he? Mm. We don't like him. She took a ferry from Shanghai, enrolled at Japanese language school in Tokyo, and in mid-1905 began courses at the Iowama Women's Vocational School, which offered a special teacher training program for Chinese women. She became vocal in her support for women's rights, pressed for improved access to education for women in her journals and speech, and spoke out against the practice of foot binding. During this period, Japanese forces defeated Russia in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, which had erupted in a battle to control Manchuria. Do you remember doing that in history?
Nah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't go to the same kind of school as you.
What do you
mean? I know you went to a state school, but you went to, like, a nice one in the countryside.
Yeah, well, yes, so Manchuria, which was a strategically situated and materially rich province in northeastern China. An Asian power's victory over a large European empire marked a turning point for the anti-king elements of China. And Zhu fell in with a community of rebellion plotters who were able to operate with relative impunity in Tokyo. She learned bomb-making, practiced marksmanship and fencing, and added essays and other long-form journalism to the works of poetry she had begun writing in her teens.
Her journey so far has been one hell of a thing. Like,
it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, from like a really like cosy childhood to marrying a dickhead to going to Tokyo to learn, become a teacher, now making bombs. It's like the logical...
Oh, it's what all people do. Yeah. I don't know about you, but if you're ever a teacher, the next step is making bombs.
Yeah, you've got to have a hobby, you know?
Oh, it's so weird. I love it. Because Chinese society was so deeply segregated during the late Qing period, the average Chinese person had not received an education of any significance or one that would be comparable to what writers, journalists, poets, or even public servants had mastered in their own youth. Sensing the true revolutionary spirit that lay in these millions of semi-literate Chinese, Zhu was among the first to promote publishing in a common vernacular that could be easily understood by the masses. And so in Tokyo, Zhu began editing a journal called Balua Bao, which was one of the first of its kind in a common vernacular.
Cool. So like a newspaper for the average person.
Yeah, I think it's essentially just not an academic paper.
Okay.
I'm not sure there were many of them kicking about that were just for everyone to read.
Mm.
An issue of the journal from 1904 contains one of her best known writings, titled A Respectful Announcement to My Sisters, in which she argued that women should reject the traditional patriarchal culture that still governed China and kept its female subjects in a feudalistic state of economic powerlessness. China's women still remain in the dark and gloom, she asserted. Feet bound so tiny, hair combed so shiny, tied, edged, and decorated with flowers and bouquets. We spend our lives only knowing how to rely on men. For everything we wear and eat, we rely on men. Mm. Pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, and that was obviously at the time, is very much a sentiment shared in many other places in the world that women needed and deserved independence.
Mm. It's powerful, I love it. Around this time, Zhu was drawn further into the revolution through her cousin Zhu Jilin, whose own formative time in Japan overlapped with some of her time there. Zhu vetted her for membership in the anti-king group Guangfuhui, which translates as Revive the Light Society or the Restoration Society. Zhu joined Guangfuhui in the spring of 1905, and in August of that year, it came under the umbrella of a larger group of anti-king plotters, Tongmenhui, or the Revolutionary Alliance. Tongmenhui's main figure was the revolutionary Sun Yat-sen, a leader who would eventually unyoke the country from the ineffectual Qing dynasty. This is so political, but it's just, there's so much going on, I love it. Xu became one of the senior ranking women in Tongmenhui, and she was responsible for recruiting other members into clandestine local cells. She returned to China in early 1906, settling first in Shanghai, where she and another female poet, Zhu Ziwa, launched the publication Zhonggu Nuba, which translates as Chinese Women's Journal. Unfortunately, it published two issues before folding due to lack of funds.
You know what it's like when you've got that indie zine?
Yeah, I know.
You think it's a great thing, and it probably is, but people just, they don't appreciate.
But this was before the decline of the printing press.
Well, you know, like, it's not that different.
Yeah, I'm sure she had the same problems. Okay. Her stay in Japan had transformed her into a figure of some minor notoriety. She felt emboldened enough to dress in men's clothing, inspired in part by folk heroines in classical Chinese sagas. She said, "I want somehow to have the mind of a man," she wrote in a letter to a family member. "If I first take on the appearance of a man, then I believe my mind too will eventually become like that of a man." It's interesting.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, It's the whole, you know, it's the whole rhetoric of the time, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. She's still doing good shit. I know it sounds weird now. It sounds like not a good thing to say now, but it's revolutionary, mm-hmm. So, yeah. Unlike traditional and other nationalist views that held women's place as mothers and educators in a traditional family role, Chiu Jin saw the traditional family as oppressive to women. In late 1905, Xu's cousin, Zhu Zilin, had founded a school for young women in Shaoxing, the city in Zhejiang province from which her family originated. This was the Datong Normal College, and in February of 1907, Zhu took over from him as director of the school. So she's really doing that journey now. Yeah. She did the bomb making and now she's being a head teacher.
Going back to her education.
Yeah.
Very good.
Bomb making was a hobby, come on.
Bomb making class? Why not?
Does it in after school club? Actually, not far from the truth.
Okay.
In 1907, she and her cousin Zhu began plotting an uprising they planned for July 19th, 1907. Yeah, we love an uprising. By then, he had purchased a civil service post in Anqing, the capital of Anhui province, as an assistant superintendent at the police academy. Information about a potential rebellion supposedly timed to erupt in two separate provinces eventually reached En Ming, the governor of Anhui province, who ordered an official hunt to discover the identities of the plotters. Fearful that the July 19th plan would be aborted, Zhu invited En to visit the police academy for an inspection of cadets in the first week of July. When the governor arrived, Zhu fired three shots into him from a pistol and publicly proclaimed his support of the anti-king movement. He was taken into custody and, after En died from his wounds, was issued the grimmest of death sentences by the vice-governor of the Anhui province. His heart was excised from his body while still beating and offered to the victim's family as a tribute.
Everything is so dramatic.
Yeah, I know. This is a very... I don't know what's the word. Yeah, like cinematic.
Visceral.
Yeah, it's a very... I need a film about it, and I'm pretty sure there is one, but it would make for a heck of a story.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it is a heck
Special
of a story.
Special effects budget would be through the roof, but I'd watch that.
Oh, God. Okay. The sentence was carried out on July 6th, but Zhu did not learn of it until July 9th, reading about it in a Shanghai newspaper. Lovely way to find out the death of a family member.
Not cool.
No. She was warned that officials would be coming for her at the Datong school, but she stayed anyway, writing to her sword sister, Zhu Yanhua, that she was determined to die for the cause. On July 13th, Xu was arrested.
Sword sister.
I know.
I love it.
Sword sister.
A sword sister.
Yeah, I'd say we could be them, but we're not. No.
We are lacking in swords.
Lacking in the sword department. Mm. Okay. Refusing to yield information about the July 19th plot or the identities of others in the Guangfuhui or Tongmenhui groups, she was tied to revolutionary activities through incriminating materials discovered in her living quarters. It said that she was even tortured and she still refused to give any information.
Badass.
Yeah. The governor... Oh. The governor of...
How are you going with that?
I just tried to say governor, but I was going to say governor! I don't know why.
The governor?
Yeah, the governor. That's how they spoke then. The governor of Zhejiang province ordered her to be put to death, and she was beheaded in her ancestral city of Shaoxing on July 15th, 1907. So, in case you didn't piece that together, which I honestly did not, she was taken back to where she was born, to be put to death in front of.
So dramatic!
Isn't it crazy? Okay. While her cousin's assassination of En Ming was deemed a shameful act that had prompted a swift and appropriate official response, Xu's execution was judged an overly punitive action. News of her death received widespread coverage, and some of the Zhejiang province officials involved in the summary trial were forced to resign. In the end, her death did little to tamp out anti-king sentiment. A more coordinated effort by Tongmenhui under Sun Yat-sen's leadership was ultimately successful in 1911. Yeah, her death was not, the opening line was that she was a martyr, she died for the cause, which she did. Unfortunately, her death didn't do much in itself to, like, promote her cause of the anti-king regime. But it was only 4 years later that the group, the organisation she was a part of, was successful in overthrowing her regime.
I mean, it takes a long time to overthrow a regime.
It doesn't happen overnight.
Uh-uh.
So, in early 1912, the last emperor of China, six-year-old Puyi, was forced to abdicate.
Oh, this feels so bad.
Oh, no. He's the head of a brutal, like, regime.
He's not got any knowledge of what is happening. But just imagine. He's like a little...
He wasn't hurt. He was just abdicate. He just abdicated.
I know, but just be like... told to get off your throat.
Oh my god, there are worse things to happen to a six-year-old.
I would cry.
Oh my god, it probably saved him a lot of pain. Sun Yat-sen, who was the leader of Tongmenhui, became the leader of the newly declared Republic of China. But instability, turmoil, and civil war blighted nearly four decades of 20th century Chinese history. Sun's Republic of China was eventually forced to retreat to Taiwan when Mao Zedong's communist forces were victorious in 1949. A generation of Chinese women came to revere Xi as a folk hero. She wasn't a folk hero, she was a real hero. But I know that...
But she, I think she would have loved that, though, yeah, because she looked up to characters like, well, not real people,
yeah.
Like Mulan.
But it seems weird to describe someone's, like folk kind of implies like legend and myth to me a little bit, and it's very recent in the history to be declaring her folk.
Or maybe folk as in
grassroots.
Yeah, as in a hero of the people.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with that. I like that.
Yeah.
That sounds more right. Her unfinished semi-autobiographical novel, Stones of Jingwei Bird, provides a forceful statement against gender oppression and evidence of a gifted literary talent whose wings were clipped mid-journey.
Mm.
The bird of the title refers to a determined creature from Chinese mythology who attempted to fill the ocean with pebbles. Bloody love all this imagery. To this day, Qiu Jin is a symbol of women's independence in China. She is now buried in Si Hui, West Lake, in Hangzhou, where a statue marks her tomb.
Oh.
And... bonus feature.
Yeah.
Would you like to end on one of her poems?
Yes, please.
Okay. Just a short stay at the capital, but it's already the mid-autumn festival. Chrysanthemums infect the landscape. Autumn is making its mark. The infernal isolation has become unbearable here. All 8 years of it make me long for my home. It is the bitter guile of them forcing us women into femininity. We cannot win. Despite our ability, men hold the highest rank. But while our hearts are pure, those of men are rank. My insides are afire in anger at such an outrage. How could vile men claim to know who I am? Heroism is born out of this kind of torment. To think that so putrid a society can provide no camaraderie brings me to tears.
Wow, that is so powerful.
She's so good, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's just something else. I fucking love her.
That's great.
There you go.
Wow. So she definitely contributed to the fall of the regime and to empowering women to seek greater independence and not just to fall into the expected pattern. Although, obviously, as we often talk about on this podcast, these are forgotten women, these are badass women from history that you probably have never heard about.
Yeah.
Because they were stamped out, and that's because they were fucking forced to be reckoned with.
Mm.
And the powers that be were afraid of her.
Yeah. I think she's still got a pretty strong legacy in China. And obviously this is coming from us having never heard of her.
Yeah.
But also I don't think her legacy extends beyond China, really. And she's so important that it's the kind of story that merits being heard all over, and it's doesn't need to be confined. Yeah. Like, it's, yeah.
That's very cool. Thank you very much.
No problemo.
I did not know anything.
I enjoyed
about
researching
her.
That, and I actually used the uni library resources for it as well for the first time properly.
Proper
I know.
Gosh.
I know, I used a real book.
I might have to step up my game.
Well, a real online book.
Ah, okay. That's
but cool. You could see the pages, like, Visually, it was a book. It felt proper.
That was very good. Thanks.
No problemo.
So that was episode number...
Eight.
Yeah.
Eight for mates.
Uh-huh.
Eight for dates.
Eight for great.
Eight for great.
What? Oh my god. Episode number great.
Oh god. Brilliant. I'm so glad we did that.
Me too. Not that it's recorded or anything. Everyone can hear what an absolute weirdo I am. So do you want to give a little plug for the socials?
Yeah, and also we did mention it before, but don't forget we did our first episode of That's What She Read, and that went out last week, which is a really exciting new sort of side thing. How do we describe we're going to say it? It's a part of the podcast where we talk about books.
It's a bonus podcast.
A bonus thing. Bonus episodes where we talk about feminist books. It's going to be really cool. So listen to the first episode, which was Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies by Scarlett Curtis.
Yeah.
And there'll be another one at some point. So keep your eye out for that.
We're going to try and keep them as regular as we can, obviously. Books take time to read, y'all.
Yeah, this is our priority. So, articles are quicker to read, so.
And tweets are even quicker.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Instagram posts. Oof, yeah. Flying through them.
Speaking of, what? Segue.
OMG.
Do make sure you follow us on the socials. Okay.
We're on Twitter, That's What She Pod.
Yep. Instagram, That's What She Said _ podcast.
Facebook, That's What She Said podcast.
Okay. And email us anything. At all, you can criticize my
that's okay, sure, anything at
no,
all.
I will take that. I want anything. Yeah, criticize my pronunciation of Chinese words and names because I'm ready for that.
Send me praise for my amazing jokes.
Yeah, that. Yeah. And also we're still accepting listener stories from the inspirational women in your life.
Yep.
The women that have inspired you.
And as we've had for the last couple of episodes, we have another song, which is by a very cool band called Lucia from Glasgow. And this is their latest single, Blue Heart.
Dope. Thank you.
Enjoy, everyone.
Bye.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.